Well, good afternoon, Juno. It's about 5 seconds before 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. I have a wonderful lineup of guests today. A couple of the cast members from Perseverance Theater's Betrayal, that you just heard the spot for, will be with us here shortly, and we'll talk to them after National Native News. Carl Broderson will drop by with a little information about the JWAC World Quest, a little trivia contest coming up this weekend. Sustainability at the Alaska Brewery is the subject of our segment. With information about Sustainable Juneau. They've recently converted their boilers to actually burn the byproduct of the brewing process. So we'll hear from them about how they did that. And a high school class that's investigating traditional ecological knowledge will be here to join us for our usual segment in the afternoon on Tuesday about the goings-on in the high school system, or in the school system here in Juneau. So first, National Native News.
Native Voice 1. The Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The president of the National Congress of American Indians, Jefferson Keel, was among civil rights leaders invited to watch President Obama publicly take office Monday in Washington, D.C. Keel says he was about 40 or 50 feet from the president. He says the response from tribes has been positive.
Although the Native Americans or tribes were not mentioned in his speech, the fact that I was able to be on the platform with the president as a tribal leader speaks volumes for our partnership and the relationship that Native Americans have with this administration.
Keel also attended the prayer service at St. John's Cathedral prior to the oath of office. Keel says tribes will address land into trust, protecting women, and a number of other issues with the administration this year.
We want to look at continuing process of the Affordable Care Act and the implementation and how the Indian Health Care Improvement Act falls under that. So there are just a number of things that we want to continue to work on.
NCAI will lay out tribal priorities next month with the State of Indian Nations address. The National Museum of the American Indian, blocks from the U.S. Capitol building, celebrated the presidential inauguration with the first Native Nations Ball. It included a handful of Native entertainers from across the country. One of the Southwest's best mixers, Keith Martinez, known as DJ Kiss Zuni, was one of them.
My purpose was just to keep the flow of everything going. So as the night started, I played like dinner music, just background music, nothing too overkill, nothing too grabby, just kind of like just keeping the flow going. Once the first performer started, I would take in the breaks and just started bringing it up, you know, start bringing the vibe a little higher and higher. And towards the end of the night, we hit them with some disco, some 80s, some 90s, and the crowd was on the floor pretty much most of the night, which was awesome because at the end I got the... We're back home when I'm done DJing, usually when the time limit hits or when everything's done, back home they'll say, one more song. And it was crazy because that actually happened last night.
DJ Kiss is from the Zuni tribe in New Mexico and says he was proud to represent his people at the inaugural event. A Native American U.S. congressman is adding his voice to the Indian mascot debate. D.C.'s mayor recently said discussions over the Washington Redskins' name need to be addressed. KGOU's Kirk Gortney reports.
Oklahoma 4th District U.S. Representative Tom Cole told Roll Call that the Washington Redskins should change the team name. Cole is a member of the Chickasaw Nation and a Republican. He says the current name is very offensive. Cole says unlike terms of respect like chiefs or warriors connected to Native Americans, Redskins is needlessly offensive to a large part of our population. The congressman, whose district includes many Native American tribes, says other ethnic terms tied to a football team would not be accepted. Cole is an admitted Dallas Cowboys fan and says any change in the name of the Washington NFL team is up to its owners. For National Native News, I'm Kurt Gwartney in Norman, Oklahoma.
During this month in 2009, the State Tribal Collaboration Act was introduced in the New Mexico legislature to improve the government-to-government relationship with the state's 22 tribes. The act included appointing a tribal liaison to every cabinet-level agency and requiring the governor to hold an annual summit with tribal leaders. The bill was signed into law less than 2 months later. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. This is a court-ordered legal notice for Native Americans. The Cobell Indian Trust Settlement is approved. If you believe you might be included in the settlement, you need to file a claim by March 1, 2013 to get a payment. Information is available at the website indiantrust.com or by calling 1-800-961-6109. That's indiantrust.com or 1-800-961-6109. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
You're in tune with KTLO News. It's 6 minutes after 3 o'clock. This is Juno Afternoon. I'm Pat Moore. I'm your host today for Juno Afternoon, and I have with me two members of the cast of Betrayal, Daniel Billett and Aaron Wiseman. Daniel's from L.A., and he's playing the part of Jerry, and Aaron Wiseman is here from Anchorage. We'll be taking the play home with him, I guess, in April. Is it that you're playing up there, March or April?
In April,
in
yes.
In April, yeah.
Yes.
And Robert's down from Anchorage. He's playing, or I'm sorry, Aaron is down from Anchorage. He's playing the part of Robert. So welcome, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, we were talking before we opened the mics a little bit about the nature of Pinter's sense of time here, because he really messes with the audience's head as the story of this affair is told.
Yeah, well, the play takes place mostly, for the most part, backwards. So you, as an audience member, you know what's going to happen even as you're watching things unfold, which puts you in a really sort of different place where you're thinking constantly about how this relates to what you've already seen, as opposed to trying to guess what's going to happen. You're trying to guess what's happened already, which is very different from usual.
Now, I'm interested in the challenge from the acting standpoint, because in most plays, you can play it with the knowledge that they're not going to know how it's going to come out. But do you have to do a shift here? Do you have to switch the way you think about what the audience's role in your acting?
In a sense, I think a lot of, in my case, I'll speak for myself, that a lot of times what you're playing is the action. And, you know, in other words, what is it that you want out of this person? So in that sense, it doesn't change. We do have to think a little bit about timing and where we are in our life in that sense. So, but, you know, because you're playing action, it doesn't change too much if you just think of we're just changing the order in which we do it.
Yeah, I think it's pretty much exactly the same as you would do a normal play, because as an actor, you know how the play is going to end, even if the audience doesn't.
Yeah.
So you've got to forget that through the first several scenes. I mean, for my character, I'm pretty oblivious throughout most of the play, except I don't think I am. I think I'm sitting on
top.
I think I'm totally in control of the situation and am completely wrong, which is how I am in most of my life. So that's pretty easy for me to do. I am totally oblivious,
right?
About most of what's going on around me, and I don't think so. So so it's easy job. But yeah,
the relationship between the two of you has to change radically during the play, but it can't really be very external. You have to do it it's almost like a silent film, in the sense that most of what you have to do, if that works, is on a very cerebral level. So how do you prep that up? How did the two of you do that? First of all, are you friends off stage?
Well,
do you come around?
Becoming slowly.
No, we don't like each other at all.
He's terrible.
No, we get along great.
So you play squash and.
Yeah, right. Well, yeah, that's
a topical reference.
That's a play. Yeah, all reference right. To the play. But no, we get along great. I mean, I think Aaron has the tougher job as far as that goes, because he actually
has to switch.
He knows what's going on and he has the change. And
whereas some of the time.
Well, yeah. Well, for when you see him in the play, it's actually almost all the time he actually knows what's going on.
Right.
And so I think the bigger question there is about the way that Pinter writes, is because none of that is really in the text. Nobody says, I know what's going on, yeah, ever. You know, things are always talked around. And so it's the subtext, it's what's going on underneath the words that is, to me, fascinating to watch.
A week ago, we had Boston Christopher on. And he said exactly the same thing. His comment was exactly what just said.
Okay.
Yeah. So interesting that all of you have that. That the cast seems to have that going through. Shona was here with him as well,
cool.
And she echoed the same kind of thought. So, anyway, really, the play is the three of you.
Yeah,
the three of us. The cast is tiny.
There is the Italian waiter in the restaurant who's
right.
James does a great job. But it is very much about the three friends, lovers, husbands, wives, like between, I don't know how you define it.
The lovers triangle, I guess, is what I've been calling it.
But somebody I think pointed out that it's got to be one of the weirdest isosceles triangles anyone ever.
Yeah,
I guess isosceles wouldn't be right because that'd be even sides,
right.
And this one, the sides
yeah,
are definitely
no, this is,
not
this
even.
Is a very obtuse
yeah.
triangle.
Yeah,
yeah. So,
there you go.
Yeah.
At least Jerry is fairly obtuse.
Yes. Most of the time, but there are a lot of other characters that you never see, which have play really big roles in the play.
Yeah.
Jerry's wife is a kind of constant presence, and then there's writers that both of them are literary. Jerry's an agent, and Robert's a publisher, and they have clients in common, and they keep coming up throughout the show. So there are a lot of sort of unseen characters who play really big roles.
Do you have to visualize those people?
I do. I have a really clear picture of both of those people.
Yeah, to an extent, certainly.
So you know what Judith looks like. That's your wife.
My wife.
Your wife.
Jerry's wife. Yeah.
Right.
I know exactly what Judith looks like. Yeah.
And how do you put her together? Why do you know? Why does she have to look the way you've envisioned her?
Well, I mean, because she's, for me, you know, she's imaginary. So she's. For from the actor's perspective, she has to serve the function that to give me what I need, so that when I talk about her, I have a clear picture, and so that essentially you can form a picture of Judith based on what I say. I just think the more specific we are about stuff like that, the easier it is for an audience to recognize. To feel that. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Have you played other roles where you've had to invent an offstage character?
Yeah, sure.
I'm
trying to think now, but I did a Tennessee Williams play a couple years ago where it was a really rarely done play called A House Not Meant to Stand. It was his final play. It was actually lost for many years.
Huh.
And in that one, there's a couple of characters that never appear who died, and so you have to have a very clear picture of those people because they inform the entire play.
And both of you have to envision this the author that Jerry discovers and Aaron, your character, refuses to publish. And so,
Did
the two of you collaborate on his offstage image?
You know, we haven't, but. One of the big parts of our process in terms of rehearsing this, and I don't know if Boston Christopher had talked about it when you talked to him before, but is we do a lot of work on what we would call the given circumstances. So the things that you can deduce from the script or that are specifically mentioned but that aren't directly a part of it, but that you either refer to, that sort of thing. So there's a fair amount of that happening where we work on that. In rehearsal,
he also that author actually gets a pretty specific physical description at somewhere in the play, but I think the other thing, I mean, it sort of leads to the thing that this play is all about secrets, you know, and so our rehearsal process was all about secrets as well. There's a lot of stuff that, or many many times throughout rehearsals where we would sort of be dragged into a corner and whispering with the director, and then you know, and all of us would at various points. Have different secrets that and that we are playing now, you know, because it really is about secrets and lies and betrayals, and it's not just the big betrayal of the play. There are so many betrayals in this play that discovering the layer upon layer and sort of peeling the onion of secret and betrayal and all of that is really, it's just a fascinating exercise. Like, getting to watch that. I actually read this play years and years ago, I think when I was in high school, and I remember thinking at the time, man, this play is brilliant. I would love to do this someday when I grow up. Mm. And so for me, it's been a real treat.
Yeah. Did you discover it before?
You know, I don't believe I've had read this play before doing this production. But having read Pinter as in school is definitely part of, you know, the curriculum for most people. And so knowing a certain amount about his famous, the Pinter pause being that a lot of students of theater would know about, is a very general
Jerry
term.
Jerry is laughing about the Pinter pause.
Yeah, the Pinter pause.
Well, and it has to do, actually, it was a takeoff of what you were saying earlier about almost like being in silent film. Well, that brings to mind the notion of the Pinter pause. There's a lot of devices that he is very specific with in his writing, and they include everything from any ellipses to pauses to silences, and those are all treated very differently, or we believe they should be.
There's a famous story about Harold Pinter doing a called a complete company meeting for a play that he was doing, and he gathered everybody together, and everybody sat down, and it was the only company meeting he called, and he said, "I'm going to make a change to the script. This comma is going to become a full stop."
Yeah. Full crowd for that purpose.
Right,
yeah.
Right, okay.
That was it, right?
That's how specific.
Okay. Well, we've made them hungry, so when can they go see it?
Thursday through Sunday, now until February 3rd.
That's right. And February 3rd is a matinee.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So Thursday through Sunday.
Seven,
is over at Perseverance on Douglas. And
7:30.
And a matinee with the last show's matinee.
Yeah.
Yep. Cool. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And a half minutes after 3 o'clock, you're in tune with KTOO News. My next guest is here to tell us about an event which is coming right up, and this is the big fundraiser of the year for the Juno World Affairs Council, the folks who bring you such a panoply of interesting speakers and wonderful events, and this is called World Quest.
That's right.
So Carl Broderson is here, and he's going to tell us a little bit about World Quest.
Yes, thank you for having me.
You bet.
It's a national event, but it occurs all throughout the year. Juno World Affairs Council is part of the World Affairs Councils of America, and they present World Quest. And I always describe it as think of a game show that is Jeopardy meets Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego.
That's our closing piece of music, by the way.
Oh, excellent. And it's your usual, I shouldn't say usual, it is an exceptional, fantastic fundraiser for Juno. We have, of course, a silent auction of wonderful experiences and goods as well as desserts. There's always sugar for everybody. And you get to have dinner, and it's a wonderful time to just hang out at Centennial Hall. But, of course, the main event of the evening is the trivia contest, which can sound like no fun or intimidating, but it really isn't. It's wonderfully entertaining, and it's very, very low-key. I mean, you show up, you find a place to seat and eat dinner, and then you end up playing this game by the end of the day.
And is the game live, or is it, so there's a caller who's asking the questions,
yes, yes.
And then
so
how does a table signify their willingness to respond?
So it's not even that on the spot. A question is presented by our wonderful MCs, which this year are Dennis Egan and Bruce Patello. And the question is asked, and you're given four multiple choice options, and you just confer amongst those at your table, mark the answer on a question sheet, and you proceed.
Oh, so you're not singing it out?
Not at all. No,
okay.
There's no point when you're on the spot at all.
Now, by this time, when the when this occurs, have you served the alcohol for the evening so that everyone is properly lubricated to think about the answers?
There is a no host bar, and overall quantities are up to individuals.
Okay, so that's the only way to get a hold of a trivia contest that I know of. So who have been the winners in the past?
It's based on teams, and so last year's winner was Uzbeki Stan. I think I may have looked out a Becky or a Stan.
Or a Stan.
And there's a perpetual trophy which has just enough space on it to have Team Uzbeki Stan engraved on it.
Where is the perpetual trophy kept?
Well, to be honest,
between contests,
usually kept at my house.
Okay.
It used to go out to individuals after they'd won it, but we had a very hard time tracking it down every year.
Obviously, you need a shrine location somewhere in town.
I think that'd be fantastic. I'll get a hold of the Capitol and see if we can put it in the lobby.
You should.
I think that'd look great.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it would also give you publicity around the year. So,
absolutely.
You charge a price for this.
Yes, so a ticket is $60 or $30 for a student. And that'll get you dinner, and it's, you know, several hours of entertainment. I mean, think of it as a long interactive movie where they also feed you.
But I would be remiss if I didn't ask you what you're going to do with the money, because you guys bring in the most incredible people to
thank
talk.
Thank you. Yeah, so JWAC's purpose is to bring the world to Juno, is how we're putting it. I mean, folks that are experts in their field, we bring them up here and have them talk about it. Usually professors or diplomats, things that could be described as political, but that's almost too narrow of a definition. I mean, just anyone who knows about the broader world and can tell us with great detail about something, we'll bring them up and have them talk. And of course, it's expensive to get folks here.
Yeah.
So this is our biggest fundraiser of the year.
Now, do you know yet who's going to be invited to speak next season?
We don't. I don't want to say put together on the fly, but it's a very fluid scheduling process.
Because you're taking advantage of world affairs.
Exactly,
to some extent.
And what is relevant right now, of course, is going to change. And then also just people's availability. But enticing them by saying, do you want to come to Alaska, is usually a very good way to get an expert to come up here and tell us about something.
Yeah. Now, normally these talks are done here at KTOO.
Yeah.
Down in the studio downstairs. And then they are normally recorded, and we put them on 360 North later.
Yes, Katie's been a great help with broadcasting all over the state.
You can see it even if you can't get to Juno for the sit-down.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Yep. And that little studio down there doesn't hold a huge crowd.
Not a huge crowd, but I mean, we can fill it in pretty well. And if need be, we'll find a large venue if we have somebody that's particularly likely to bring in a huge amount of people to watch.
Yeah. So. Carl, you're a longtime Junoite.
Yeah, born and raised.
How'd you get interested in JWAC?
To be honest, the long story, I was brought in 6 years ago now by a friend of mine as a ringer to be on his team. Supposedly I was going to know all the answers, and I am embarrassed to say I made the difference on literally one question.
Okay, what was it?
Which of the following countries is not a member of the EU, and the answer was Norway.
Okay.
So at least it was nice that I could, you know, put down Norway and very definitively get up and walk and turn the question in. But
on the rest of them, you were
exactly
loss.
and you know, part of it is I simply didn't know, but part of it also is that because this is a national event, World Affairs Council of America provides a question bank that people can use to assemble their own local version of WorldQuest, and we had done that year, and the questions were very overly specific and esoteric. I mean, the example I like to give is, what is the GDP of Micronesia in 1972?
Oh, well.
And we'll give you four
answers.
Double
jeopardy, within
10 million.
I think, last week, but I may not have written it down.
Exactly, yeah. And so, I mean, things that, you know, I hate to say it, but you wouldn't know, and you certainly probably wouldn't care either. I mean, it's not something that affects your life or that you would have come across. And so I expressed something to that effect to folks afterwards, and they looked at me with a twinkle in their eye and said, you have just shown interest, young man. And next year I was helping run the thing. One thing I love about
Juno. So are you still using the national question
bank? No, we abandoned it. I attempted to use it.
So now you're doing your own.
That first year, yeah. And so now I write all the questions. And it's a long endeavor, and you feel kind of exposed out there because it's kind of a performance art project that you're putting together.
Yeah.
And hopefully people like it. And you just go from there.
Well, I have to say you're no stranger to performance art. I don't know how many of our listeners have ever checked in on your website, but it's designed as a sort of a trap for those of us who periodically check someone's name on the internet. It's very well done.
Thank you very much. Mostly it was intended to convince relatives that I was getting out of the house. That was the original thought.
And did you get out of the house?
Oh, yes. I'll always attempt to.
Yeah, you're working for MRV, I think, right?
Yeah. Do good work over there. Enjoy it. I think the most important thing I do at this point is the Christmas card each year. But yeah.
Well, following this is the we've been doing sections on sustainability, and one of my interviews in the past was with MRV Architects because of the Green Award that they have the building over there.
Exactly. MRV's was, the first commercially LEED certified building in the state.
Yeah,
for green and sustainability.
So it was very interesting. We did a walkthrough over there and like that.
Yeah.
A couple of a few weeks ago. Okay, so JWAC, when is the event?
It is this Friday, the 25th. It's at Centennial Hall. Doors open at 6. You can get tickets at the door, as Juno is always wont to do, or you can get them ahead of time on our website, which is www.jwac.org.
Okay, and because you have the no-host bar, you're asking that participants under 21 come
please
with a
parent
or guardian?
Please do bring a parent, yes. Okay, and if you're at all inclined, dress internationally.
Ah,
if you've got some later hoodies in the closet, bring them on.
Okay, or you're sorry or...
anything like that, yeah.
Whatever, right. Uh-huh. Okay, good. Outstanding. Well, I hope you get at least two Polynesian dancers showing up to
answer questions. That would be fantastic. Do you know of any who are planning?
No, but we'll put out a call right now.
Excellent.
Let's see if we can interest someone in coming. Carl Brodersen, thank you so much for alerting us to World Quest.
Thank you very much for having me.
You bet. A little appropriate music to go out with here.
Well, she sneaks around the world from Vienna to Carolina. Sticky-fingered filcher from Berlin down to Belize. She'll take you for a ride on those boats to China. Tell me, where in the world is
Carmen Sandiego?
Steal their soul in South Korea, making that it comes right also from the Red Sea to Greenland. They'll be seeing the blues. Well, they never Arkansas her steal for me, come from the jungle. Tell me,
in the world is
Carmen Sandiego.
She goes from Nashville to Norway, out to Zimbabwe, Chicago to Czechoslovakia and back.
Well, she'll run down Pakistan and run again in Scandinavia. Then she'll stick them up down under and go big pocket first.
She was the
miss and misdemeanor when she stole the beans from Lima. Tell me,
where in the world is
Carmen Sandiego?
Be.
Ooh, Botswana to Thailand, Milandia to Yamali to Bali, Ohio, Hawaii!
Around the globe, make sure flip them every nation. She's a double feeling people with a taste for thievery. Her itinerary's loaded up with moving violations. Tell me,
where in the world is
Carmen Sandiego?
Oh, tell me,
where in the world is Carmen Sandiego?
Tell me,
where in the world is Carmen Sandiego?
Where could she be?
Yeah. Well, with a little false start there. This is our little discussion of sustainability that we've been doing since the last farmer's market over at the Jack in the end of August. And we've looked at a whole bunch of different aspects of sustainability. My guest today is going to tell us about a really interesting sustainable project here in Juneau where the brewery has worked out a way to brew beer using energy generated by the byproduct of the actual brewing process. Brandon Smith, who is the engineering manager for the Alaskan Brewery, is here with us. So welcome to the show, Brian.
Hi, Pat. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So tell us how this thing of yours came about and how it works.
Sure. Well, as a lot of home brewers in town know, brewing beer takes a tremendous amount of energy. It doesn't start out as the nice cold product we all love and enjoy. To start the brewing process, you have to have a lot of hot water. You mix hot water with grain, so of course that water has to be heated to start with. And then towards the end of the brewing process, you have what's known as wort, which is the sweet liquid that eventually turns into beer. Well, we have to boil that for 60 to 90 minutes, and that takes a tremendous amount of energy. And those are really two of the biggest energy needs in the brewery. Add to that the fact that because we're in Juneau, we don't have any cows that can take our spent grain product. Down south, breweries give this stuff away for free. It's great animal feed. Not having that luxury, we have to dry our spent grain just to be able to ship it south. So, again, drying takes even more energy. So we're already behind the curve as compared to other breweries. So traditionally, that energy is supplied in the form of steam, just like boilers in people's houses or in hotels or buildings. And traditionally, we've generated that by burning fuel oil, again, just like a lot of people in Juneau. And as we all know, it's very expensive to do that, and it's not getting any cheaper, unfortunately. So back in 2008, we started investigating how we could use this spent grain byproduct as a fuel source. Now, we've been burning this stuff since the mid-90s. When we put in our current large brew house, that was when we had to start drying our grain. We burn part of the dry grain
to be able to ship it out.
Dry it to ship it out. But we're able to burn part of that to generate heat to dry more grain. So we've always been able to burn a third to half of our dry spent grain. Unfortunately, that system is limited in what we can do with that heat because of the way it's set up. So we still have some of this left over, and animal feed is a really low-value use of this material. The cows love it, of course, because it comes from beer, but, you know, when you look at the other things that you could be doing with it. So we started looking at this in 2009, and it was really shocking to find out just how much more value this spent grain byproduct had as a fuel than as cattle feed, about 10 times the value when you figure in what we get for it as opposed to what we're paying for fuel. That was in 2009. Fuel's gotten even more expensive since then, so it's even better.
When you say the value of this fuel, are you talking about the BTU output from burning the stuff?
So the value, if you take the BTUs that are present in the grain, and that's a measure of the energy present in there, if you were to burn that, you would get this much heat out of it. Mm-hmm. And then you can convert that to an equivalent amount of fuel oil.
Yeah, we had some of that discussion when we had Alec Mestad on the show a while back about conversion rates.
Right. Yeah. So it's a very similar concept, whereas the value as cattle feed is very low. So we started investigating how we could develop a system that could burn all of our spent grain. Now, having burned this stuff for 15, 16 years, it's a bugger to burn. It doesn't burn like wood, doesn't burn like coal. It's
more like peat, right?
Almost. It has a very high protein content, and that just gets in the way of burning things. Mm-hmm. So we've had some experiences with it. We knew what our challenges were. And so when we set out to design this system, our goal was to be able to burn all of it, recover all of that energy into some mobile form that we could use not just in our grain dryer, but as well as in our brew house. So over the course of about a year and a half, through lots of pilot testing and talking to manufacturers and equipment providers, we were able to develop a system that would address some of these unique issues, unique to spent grain, as well as be able to have the capacity to burn all of it. By turning all of this energy into steam, we were able to offset all of our oil use in our dryer, so our dryer is completely steam-powered now, powered by the spent grain, as well as having capacity left over to displace some oil-fired steam in our brewing operation as well. So the dryer's oil-free now, and right now we're in the process of testing how we can start using steam in our brew house as well. It's been a kind of a long process.
So you have to dry this stuff before you can use it as fuel?
That's the way we do it.
I see.
There's a huge industry out there on burning agricultural waste with mm-hmm. varying moisture contents. Because we already were drying it, it was easy to say, well, heck, let's just keep using this because it does make a really good fuel. You can burn this stuff if it's wetter, but it comes at an energy penalty because you still have to drive mm-hmm. off that moisture to get it to burn. So however you go about it, but we just happen to have the dryer already because we were doing this for 15, 16 years.
So when you dry it, that's it, I'm assuming that's the first step of a process here. What do you do next to the grains?
Well, let's take a step back, actually.
Okay.
So most breweries use, when they mill their grain to make beer with it, they have to crack the husks open. And they use what's called a roller mill, results in a very coarse kind of grain where they just crack the hulls open. In 2008, we put in a different kind of brewing technology that has us finely mill the grain with a hammer mill. And so that results in a much finer consistency. It's kind of like coarse cornmeal, mm. kind of what it looks like, completely different than what people normally brew with. So, and that mash press, in addition to giving us a more uniform composition, it also gives us less water in our spent grain to begin with. And that's that much less water we have to drive off. So yeah, we kind of back up, and then we get into the dryer. Really, drying is all we do to it. It comes out as this very dry, less than 10% moisture, coarse stuff that's very biologically stable. We don't have to worry about it going sour. And then it conveys really easily, doesn't plug anything, and burns pretty well.
So do you just burn it as in that form? You don't have to compress it at all?
Right. We looked into whether we could pelletize our spent grain a number of years ago, and unfortunately, due to the fact that we've already taken the good sticky stuff out of it, there's nothing much left to keep it together. So we would have had to put in binders and all that. But we're actually able to use it as this loose material and burn it straight in the system that was really designed very specially for that material.
Who did the design work on the burners?
We had a number of partners in this. There was, of course, our experience. We had a couple consultants out of the Seattle area, one of whom is kind of the man in biomass burning down there, and another one who helped us with our energy load studies to determine how big it needed to be, whether it would in fact work. There was an outfit out of North Dakota that eventually built and supplied the system for us named King Coal Furnace Corporation, and they had years and years experience in agricultural waste utilization, so they were able to take that knowledge and apply it to our unique situation. So we had a number of people that really helped us along the way with it as well.
What's the payback look like?
Pretty good. At the time we started the project, it was looking like four or five, 6 years. Now, of course, fuel costs have gone up. We have had some delays in getting it started, so we were hoping to be where we are now a year ago, but that's the way these unique projects go. But I would say we're still in the 4 to 5 year range, which for this size of investment is pretty darn good.
Do you have this down to a closed loop now?
As far as the raw material to waste, we're still shipping off a little bit because we haven't completed the part of the puzzle where we're putting steam into the brew house yet. We're just starting to look at that. So we are still generating a little excess spent grain that we're still shipping south. But we were shipping about 2 to 3 20-foot vans off a week before, and now we're shipping one off every 2 weeks.
Hmm.
So we've greatly reduced it, but we haven't quite gotten to the point where we're burning it all yet until we find that extra demand, until we are able to utilize that extra demand and fully close that loop.
Now, for a while, you were dumping out at the community garden, which my garden smells like a brewery.
Yeah, well, there's worse things.
I'm all for it.
They do still take some of our material on occasion, and the gardeners like our stuff too, so it is very good soil amendment. You know, unfortunately, we wish that we could utilize it all here, but there's only so much gardening that needs to be done here in Juneau. So,
yeah. Well, I hear there's an attempt to start a community garden, I think, on Hoona. So
maybe
come over and get a boatload.
Yeah, right.
Who knows? Anyway, they will need soil amendments, I'm sure, over there, as all of us do who are gardening in the area. So are there other energy-saving developments on the horizon? You're going to move the steam into the brew house next.
Correct.
Right? So.
And as I mentioned, our grain dryer is oil-free now. And even when we're pushing as much steam as we can into the brew house, we're not going to have enough generation capacity to fully eliminate oil in the brew house. We would love to be able to. The numbers just don't look like they're going to quite get there. So our next challenge is, well, how can we reduce our energy needs in the brew house, which is probably the single largest consumer of energy in the whole brewery? So there are some design projects going on right now with some newer brewing technologies, such as a newer brew kettle. There are some very common energy recovery systems that you can get that weren't as common 15 years ago when we built that part of the operation that are definitely going to be part of it. So I would say we're focusing on the brew house right now to try and reduce the energy need there so that that steam that we do have available to go to the brew house will cover a larger and larger percentage of our needs there as time goes along. Ultimately, our goal would be to be completely off oil. It's a bit of a pie-in-the-sky goal, but I think definitely in the next year as we start putting those projects in, we'll start to see some even greater energy savings and then hopefully get to the point where oil is used as a convenience instead of as a necessity.
I get a real sense here that the Alaskan Brewery is thinking very green. Is that like part of the corporate culture of the organization?
It definitely is, and it's really a product of, you know, when we walk out our back door and we look up at the mountains and we think, well, this is where we live, you know. It's part of our corporate culture that we want to be seen as being a responsible part of Juneau. We want to do what we can with the resources that we have. And as I've said a lot of times, I think sustainability can also be very good business, not just from the public perception standpoint, but from the standpoint that if we can utilize something that isn't a fossil fuel, it's already here, let's use this as a fuel, let's keep fuel from having to be imported into Juneau for these needs. And along the way, we're saving some money too. So everybody wins. We get to save money. We get to reduce our logistics needs for bringing fuel in and reduces the fossil fuel use overall. So I think it's a win for everyone.
Brandon, thank you so much for updating us on this wonderful project. I really appreciate your coming down and explaining it to us.
Thanks for having me.
We'll continue our sustainability segments throughout the month of January and into February, looking at energy usage, food for Juneau, and all of the wonderful things that make us a little more self-reliant in the Juneau area.
The Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 22nd of January, 2013. It was on this day, 1938, Thornton Wilder's play Our Town premiered at the MacArthur Theater in Princeton, New Jersey, about the fictional town of Grover's Corners, New Hampshire, Emily Webb and George Gibbs, children in the first act, in the second act, they marry, in the third, Emily has died in childbirth, and she's looking back from beyond the grave with other dead citizens of Grover's Corner, and she decides to revisit the happiest day of her life, her 12th birthday. Thornton Wilder had trouble writing that third act. It finally came to him when he was in Zurich. He was entertaining a friend who was probably also his lover, Samuel Stewart. The two of them stayed up until dawn to hear the bells of Zurich. There was some drinking going on. It was raining. They were looking for an umbrella. And Thornton Wilder wrote the last act of Our Town, beginning with the graveyard scene, with the umbrellas. And he told Samuel Stewart that the graveyard scene came from Stewart's complaining about his feet getting wet as he was walking home. The play was revolutionary for its time. Wilder had decided not to use scenery, almost no props. He wanted his play to be more like the great Greek tragedies, and the dead people sitting in the cemetery commented much like a Greek chorus. From Princeton, the play went on to Boston, where it was a flop. It got bad reviews, played to half-empty houses, some audience members walked out. But two influential New York theater critics, Brooks Atkinson and Alexander Wolcott, convinced the director and producer to give it another try and bring it to New York. And it did better there. And it won the Pulitzer Prize for Drama, 1938. And it's now estimated that, on average, Our Town is performed at least once every night somewhere in the world. It's the birthday of the novelist Aaron Kyle, born in Peoria, 1978, grew up in Colorado, the town of Grand Junction. She liked horses, she took riding lessons, competed in horse shows, went off to college, and while she was in grad school, she wrote a short story called Foaling Season about a girl who lives on a horse ranch in a town called Desert Valley. It was published in the Atlantic Monthly, won the National Magazine Award for Fiction, and she turned it into a novel called The God of Animals. The Foaling Season is the first chapter of the book, and The God of Animals became a bestseller. The God of Animals, which begins 6 months before Polly Kane drowned in the canal, my sister Nona ran off and married a cowboy. Here's a poem for today by Deborah Garrison, entitled Poem About an Owl. I've never seen an owl, not a real one, but often enough at night have started up at the wing beats, long with loaded silence between lengths like velvet ripping, the children's book eyes, saucerish and startled with wisdom, sweeping the forest floor for a little something, and I leaped from sleep, if indeed I was sleeping, belted my robe like a mother of old, and rushed to their beds to see if it got them, the skidding talon, where they were quietly breathing in their own animal dreams. A poem by Deborah Garrison, poem about an owl, from her collection The Second Child, published by Random House, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Grove Press, publishers of The River Swimmer by Jim Harrison, two novellas that explore inconvenient love, the conflict between urbanity and nature in America's heartland, and the never-ending pursuit of balance in an imperfect world, in bookstores everywhere. And by Reputation.com, helping individuals and businesses make their best impression where people learn about them first, on the Internet. Learn more at Reputation.com. Produced by Nick Vetter, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's 13 minutes before 3 o'clock here, or 23. Let me look at the clock. 13 minutes before 3 o'clock. And you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. My next two guests are working on what sounds like a fascinating project that involves the high school and the organization they work for, the Goldberg Heritage Foundation. And this is Kate Jensen and Paul Berg. Hi.
Hello.
Hey, so tell us about this project that you're engaged in.
Well, we're very excited to be co-sponsoring a university class with the School of Education at the University of Alaska Southeast. And the class is called Investigating Traditional Ecological Knowledge. It'll be bringing the traditional systems and place-based education opportunities that Alaska provides to high school students. It'll be open for all 9th through 12th grade students. They just need to enroll with their science teachers at all three high schools are aware of it. They can get in contact with me at Goldbelt Heritage Foundation. We'll be covering a lot of different topics as we explore the area.
So, Kate, this is starting in the fall semester, next fall, or is it starting right now?
Actually, it's right around the corner. Since it's a university class, we're not quite on the semester schedule. We'll be starting February 5th and running through April 30th.
I see. And do you know how many high school credits it carries for the high school student?
Yep, the students will be earning half an elective credit for high school and three university credits.
Okay, mm-hmm. Probably in the ecology, somewhere in the ECO series in the catalog.
Well, since it's through the School of Education, they'll be focusing on science education strategies, our communication of knowledge, but they will be underneath the title of Investigating Traditional Ecological Knowledge, which is science-based. Mm-hmm. So hopefully people will recognize that.
So what kinds of activities are you anticipating you'll be doing, Paul or Kate?
Well, we're going to have a series of collegiate-level lectures. We're going to be doing some field-based experiences out at the glacier, out at Berners Bay, and at the University Computer Lab to develop some technology skills. And there will be classes twice a week for those 12 weeks. That will be utilizing Tlingit elders from the community, university professors, and Forest Service scientists.
So this is an unusual approach compared to lab science with people with white coats and doctorates and all that sort of thing. Paul, what are we looking at here? Is this the emergence of an awareness of another path to science?
Well, I think it is in a way. It's place-based education, and I think it goes back one thing. It goes back to is 20 years ago, the Indian Nations at Risk Task Force. Under the original President Bush, their number one priority recommendation after meeting in for about 15, 16 months over time was the inclusion of Native American culture, knowledge base, and language in the core of the education for indigenous students. And there's been a movement gradually more and more of recognizing the validity of the knowledge base of the indigenous people in this region, the Tlingit people, and recognizing how important this is, and to bring it into the education system, not only for Tlingit students, but for all students, as an enrichment of an expansion of knowledge about the local region.
There's quite a vibrant Tlingit language program that is arising at UAS right now. I've had the lead of that program on the air here a couple of times to talk about it. And it seems to me that this is really an interesting and I have a background with the university, and I think something's coming to fruition here that that was started 4, 5, 6 years ago when there was this awareness that we were the educational system in Alaska was not actively pursuing opportunities to bring forth traditional Native knowledge, and I think that became part of the mission statement or at least a component of the mission of the University of Alaska. Is there a relationship here? Are you tying into the Tlingit language program at all?
Well, not directly with the course. I must admit, I'm in the second semester of taking Tlingit out there and am familiar with the program. And just and it's interesting learning the language. We're exposed to different cultural concepts and a different way of viewing nature and understanding nature and the interrelationships, because Tlingit is extremely complex and metaphorical and the way it deals with nature, and the place names are fascinating. But I think over time there's been just a growing realization that there is a knowledge base that is very, very important and vital to our understanding of Alaska, the land, the northern region we live in.
Kate, you were telling me about some of the activities that people are going to do. And you said that there would be elders who would be talking and like that. Do you also plan on bringing in members of the Native community to lead the field activities as well?
Absolutely. You know, there's been many organizations that have had really great success doing exactly that. Last year, Central Council Tlingit and Haida paired up with Gold Belt Heritage Foundation and ran the Hinlantini Outdoor Science Classroom. That was very predominantly led by Tlingit elders such as David Katzik, Paul Marks. It was wonderful. And what we found was that the two knowledge systems really complement each other. So we had really progressive scientists. We had Rick Edwards and Dave Damore involved from the Pacific Northwest Laboratory, and they would co-teach topics together side by side with Tlingit elders and in the field, in the place, not just in the textbook. And it was phenomenal. The students were able to present out a very articulate ways how this changed their way that they see the world. It wasn't just about science. It was very interdisciplinary when you do it from both approaches.
In these experiences, did you discover any tension between the what would you call them, Western scientists and the traditional knowledge bringers? Were they welcoming, or was there a tension?
They were absolutely welcoming. I think there were dialogues that came out of it that were really productive. The focus was on the positive complementing of the two knowledge systems. So where do these areas blend? Where is the overlap? How can knowledge from one benefit the other? You know, how can we add oral narratives and thousands of years of history to better understand the glacier's migration right now and the scientific, you know, Western data that we have on that, because they're both science and they're both very in-depth knowledge bases. It was wonderful to see everyone working together, especially when you add youth into it. The focus becomes really clear.
I want to return to the concept of language for a moment, and it seems to me that there's an interaction between the way in which you speak about the world and the way in which you comprehend the world. So I'm curious as to why you are not incorporating a language component into the program.
Oh, we will be incorporating language, absolutely.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I didn't get that impression from the answer. Okay, so.
The Tlingit oratory responses are some of the most metaphorical, expressive speeches I've ever seen, and to provide students with the ability to foster that skill and to learn from people who model it is going to be absolutely appropriate, not just for that education strategy of communication, but for how we perceive the land. Lance Twitchell from the university, I heard him once say that it says something when you name people after places or you name places after people.
Yeah. Lance is the fellow that I've interviewed mm-hmm. a couple of times here on the show, and he's talked, he wrote an editorial which had this wonderful concept of all of us need to hold hands. His metaphor was the trees in the rainforest. The ones that stand are not deeply rooted. Their rooting systems stretch out to the sides and intertwine with the other trees.
That's what
causes them to be able to hold up for so long in the wind. It's not Twitchell's idea. He got it from a Tlingit elder, and he acknowledges that. But that's a wonderful metaphor, I think, for what you're doing here.
I think that's really the focus of the class, is that building of community. You know, I've heard it called the trifecta, when you get universities, school districts, and community-based organizations working together for the betterment of youth. You really do build a community, and everybody feels involved, and then they have a role, they have a place to contribute.
So how do students, once again, become involved in your ecological knowledge class?
Well, Henry Hopkins is helping us at Juneau Douglas High School. He has more information. They have enrollment forms to get you signed up. You come and contact me at Gold Belt Heritage Foundation. If you can look them up on the Internet, they have all their information on there. And then at Thunder Mountain High School, Eric Lundquist and John Smith and Topaz Shira, they're all people that are able to get students more information.
Well, here is a uniquely Juneau-based extra credit, or not extra credit, but what's the word for the students are getting a half hour of
dual enrollment credits,
yeah,
the three university
credit.
Credits and the half
yeah,
of high school.
Yeah. So a wonderful opportunity to further your education and to do it in a way that is unique to our area down here.
And the
Thank
tuition
you.
Is included.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah, so you don't have to pay for university right. tuition, which is a fairly expensive proposition. Thank you so much for telling us about the program.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Shona Strasser from Susu and the Prophets. Join us for an amazing night of classic rock with KRNN's next Spotlight Series event on February 6th at the Gold Town Theater from 7 to 9 p.m. You'll hear your favorite classic rock songs from AC/DC to The Zombies to The Who, Heart, and of course, The Zeps. We won't bite off any bat heads, but we can guarantee a great night of the music that made rock classic. Get tickets at krnn.org or the station.
This is Bird Note. We've all heard about the early bird getting the worm. We know it as sound advice about initiative and timely action, and we can almost see that robin leaning back and tugging that recalcitrant worm out of the ground. Research shows, however, that birds dining early and heavily may lower their life expectancy. A study of three North American woodland bird species found that socially dominant birds stay lean during the day and then stoke up when it's most important, later in the day, before a cold night. At night, birds avoid hypothermia by metabolizing fat, and by staying lean through most of the day, dominant birds are more agile in avoiding predators. Subordinate birds have to look for food whenever and wherever they can find it, and carry fat on their bodies to hedge against unpredictable rations. Dominant birds, which can push subordinates off food, can choose when they eat, and so lessen their odds of being eaten themselves. Therefore, at least in the woodland bird's world, the revised moral might read, get the worm late in the day. You'll sleep better and live longer. Hey, do you sometimes miss Bird Note on the radio? Catch up with it online at birdnote.org.
Andy Klein's hosting on Wednesday, and he has a good lineup of guests. Stacy Polson will come in about Nugget Mall. Eric Olson will be here. Cycle Alaska Bike Touring in Europe. Jump Society Film Festival coming up. Wayne Regalin will be here with a preview of Wildlife Wednesday and the information on Eagle Crest. This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas, and we're also on translators throughout the area. K276 AF, 103.1 in the Valley and Auk Bay. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, 101.7 K26. 69AO, Gustavus, K201AM 88.1, and K220BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet, we're on K210AS at 89.9.